Welcome to RGM. Are you in a band? Come and join us. Simply click on the RGM submission page, submit your music, and we'll sort the rest. Hi, we made it through another week, didn't we? Together. Welcome to the RGM Experience Podcast, ladies and gentlemen. The music industry podcast where we delve into the grassroots music industry and beyond. finding interesting people to speak to and having that chat and sharing it with you, the podcasters, the RGMers, the listeners, you lot, basically. Get bogged down with all that. Oh, a little bit of danger starting our catchphrase there. Not going there. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us again for another week. And we've got a big one for you this week, ladies and gentlemen. None other than Chris Helm from, you know, formerly of Seahorses. I did get a little bit fanboy in this one, I'll be honest. The Do It Yourself by the Seahorses is one of the iconic albums from my childhood. And we have a little talk about that. So Chris Helm is joining us later in the podcast, ladies and gentlemen. But as always, I'd just like to kick back and say hello, see how you lot are going on and all. Just catch up in general, really. So how you doing, your eight? Nice one. I've just been to the dentist this morning. Clean bill there, just a little scrape of some of the shit that you get stuck in there. But other than that, no complications, which is nice. Basically, in for 5 minutes, charge you £25 and kick you straight out. So that's been my morning, ladies and gentlemen. I am looking forward to, as I record this, I'm recording this on the Friday before the podcast comes out on Monday, you know. And this weekend, I'm really looking forward to going back to my hometown. Oh, Sheffield, I miss you. I'm going down to Now Then Festival. Loads of people on. Loads of people we've had on the podcast as well. So, like, Lissy Taylor, Paper Scenes, Slow Readers Club Redlining. Just loads going on. I'm really looking forward to a full day on it. It starts at 12. They put fucking Paper Scenes on at 12 o'clock. A bit annoyed, but I'm going to be there right from the start. So it's going to be a big, long, old day, you know, on Saturday. So I'm really looking forward to that, you know. What are you guys up to? Got any good music gigs coming your way? What are you looking forward to? Come on. Post us on the socials. Share a new band that you like. That's what it's all about. Just tag in RGM when you find a new band, and that helps us find them too. Nice one. Yeah, had a great week on RGM this week. A very busy one, thanks to Liam Gallagher playing Manchester with John Squire. That's had thousands of views on it. Everybody's loving that review. Loads of pictures and stuff from our Helen Millington, who does great work looking after all the live content here at RGM. Plus loads of interviews, videos, content, video premiere, interviews. You know it's a magazine. You know what goes on in magazines, don't you? But it's been a fun week. And loads of people have engaged with it, which is nice. Same as the episode last week with Dictator. That was nice as well. Nice to see that go down well with the boys. We're nice on the socials. Saw a few people playing it on the big tellies and that. And see my big fat head. Which is nice. I hope you're enjoying it anyway, guys. And, you know, you can watch our little faces talk to each other on that there YouTube as well. Give us a subscription. We're about 45 off getting to that magic 1,000 that I've been banging on about for the last 100 years. That'd be nice if we can get to that in the next week, a month or two. But anyway, this episode gave me a lot of joy. Really got a lot. I've seen Chris Helm play live before. What an amazing talent. What an amazing voice. What an amazing journey he's had in the music industry and through it. He talks about his days, you know, meeting John Squire and getting involved with the Seahorses after being a soloist for a bit. We go through it all. And this Friday coming out, he's got a bad, and I've heard it, it's fucking brilliant. He's got a brand new album coming out, ladies and gentlemen. So in the description of the podcast, treat yourself, get yourself a little pre-order. We do discuss it in the podcast a couple of times, because you've got to, haven't you? So, ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, I'm going to leave you, get off, and introduce you now to Chris Helm. Take it away, mate.
I'm all right, thanks. Cheers. Yeah, I'm good, thanks. Well.
Yeah, good, good. Thanks for joining us. I'm glad you're well now, because we had you booked on the podcast a bit ago, but you had an accident on some ice or something, didn't you, mate?
Yeah, I've been out with Alan Leach and and Joe Johnson from Shed 7. Well, they've left Shed 7. Right. It was just before Christmas. We met up in the pub. And it was okay. That one weekend where it was really icy.
Yeah.
And I ended up just slipping on some ice and just fell flat on my back.
Oh,
you know, when you think you can get up, but I was like, I just literally couldn't get up. And then Joe was trying to pull me up and I was in agonizing pain and all the rest of it. I ended up in hospital in the end. And it turns out I broke like four ribs in my back. So I had to cancel a few gigs, which was annoying. But I mean, thankfully, Nigel Clark from Dodgy, he managed to cover a couple of them. So that was all right. Yeah. It was annoying. It's not nice having broken ribs, I have to say. Obviously, if there's people out there that's ever experienced it, they'll know exactly what I mean.
It is, isn't it? I can remember playing rugby once at school, and I dived on a rugby ball. And it.
Oh, you were asking for it. And
it's completely my fault. There were no booze involved, though, as well. You know, just one of those things.
Well,
it's a crappy. Well,
by my normal standards, I wasn't that drunk, to be fair, so it's quite disappointing.
Fair enough.
Would have dulled the pain somewhat if I was a bit drunk.
Fair enough. Well, thanks for joining us today, mate. You know, it's the holy grail to have a career in music, and you've been there, done it, seen it, wore the T-shirt. You've got this amazing new album out, so thanks for joining us today.
No, pleasure. Absolute pleasure.
Where do we find you today, though, mate? Where's home?
I'm in York.
Okay.
This is my cat Barney.
Oh, hello, Barney.
Yeah. It's just relaxing on the bed.
Taking its time.
I'm in York. Lived here on and off pretty much most of my life, really.
Yeah.
So it's a nice place to live.
It's a beautiful place. I love York. This new album's coming out. I have had the privilege of having a sneak peek of the new album that's coming out that we're going to come to in a bit, mate. So music's still in you, mate. It's never going to leave you, is it?
No. No, it's not. I'm not very good at anything else, so fortunately, right. And it hasn't left me yet. I'm a very unhappy person when I'm not playing music.
Yeah, I can imagine.
I've given it a go at kind of doing other things.
Yeah.
Because you do it all the time, you know, you do music all the time. And, you know, when you find yourself watching Netflix rather than listening to other people's music, you're realizing that maybe you've been doing a bit too much music. So I'm kind of like more, I've got my head around it a bit more now. I've got my own little studio and I've been writing quite a lot, been doing a lot of writing with Nigel from Dodgy as well. So that's been a lot of fun. So hopefully we'll be doing something next year. But yeah, I mean, you're always getting new ideas and you're always getting, you know, sort of like, it's almost like this self-improvement thing where you just, you can go on YouTube now and pretty much learn how to do anything in any style, you know, so there's not really any excuse for kind of not being massively creative, unless you want to paint yourself into a little cul-de-sac like some bands do and they just never seem to sound any different from, you know, still trying to, recreate what they were doing years ago.
Is the process any different now to when you started off, you know, back in the early days? Is the creative process different for you now
massively,
to try and be different?
I think before, I didn't used to keep a diary or anything like that. And, you know, back in my day, pre-millennial, we weren't really taught how to process our feelings and emotions and things like that, so... You know, I'd be sitting there and pretty pissed off about things and I'd end up writing and ranting about a situation just to get it square in my head. And then, you know, then I'd write the music around that and kind of like beat it into shape. So trying to crowbar kind of like sentences into a short space of time. Whereas now I go away for like, I don't know, a couple of weeks, go to a cottage or somewhere where it's, you know, in the middle of nowhere. And me and the band will just sit and knock out a load of music, and you know, I'll have all the chords written out and stuff like that, and just sort of play it out. And I don't like to tell people what to play, so there's a reason why I have a drummer, is because I can't play drums. There's a reason why I have a double bass player or a bass player, is because I can't play bass. Lead guitar, same thing.
Yeah.
But you know, keyboards and stuff as well. And it's like, you know, and I get all these people, and they're all my friends, and we sit down and we just knock it out. And then what happens is, when it actually starts to become something quite special, and you've got it all, for lack of a better word, but it's a bit of a cheesy word, vibe. You know, when you've got that vibe going on, it's it starts to paint pictures in your head, and then you know where you're going with the song and where what needs to be said over it. Yeah. And then a lot of subconscious stuff comes out when you do that. Yeah. So you end up being quite surprised yourself by what comes out at the end. It's not kind of this contrived idea. It's more of a sort of subliminal thing, really.
Yeah. What's the quality control like?
Ridiculous.
Is it still the same as? Is it stronger later on?
Self-defeating.
Yes.
Self-defeating.
Okay.
Oh God.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. I was talking to my mate about this yesterday, and it's like, it's almost like there's this voice in your head that's telling you that it ain't good enough. Try again. Do it again.
Yeah.
Try harder. You know, a lot of the time, it's kind of that Charles Bukowski thing. It's like, you get a lot further when you don't try, actually. It just seems to be if you do it naturally. But the quality thing is, you end up with like 30 songs and you'll choose 10 of them.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean that the other, you know, 20 are crap. It's just that they just don't fit together for that body of work, you know, for an album. So it's like, for instance, every time I do an album, there's always a couple of like glam rock songs in there.
Yeah.
And eventually I'll end up with enough glam rock songs to have an album of it. But it's going to take a long time. I'll probably be about 70 by the time that happens.
I'm looking forward to the glam rock album when you're 70, Chris.
It's a lot of fun. Yeah. You know, you can write any old crap for glam rock. And it doesn't have to make any sense at all. Just catchy choruses, you clap your hands to it.
Are you the same with like the mix as well? You know, like making sure the hi-hats fucking perfect and that kind of stuff. Do you get involved with that kind of side of it?
I work with a guy called Dave Boothroyd, and he's a brilliant engineer. I've known him for a very long time, and he offered to sort of help me do this because I was going to do the mixes myself, but that was a bit of a steep learning curve for me, which would have meant the album would never have been finished. I think it's a dangerous thing to sort of be that kind of close to it.
Yeah.
So it's nice to have someone there making those decisions, and then if you agree with them or not, and if you don't, then he's quite, you know, adaptable to changing it. I learned a lot from working with him, and I am really picky about stuff, but it's only because it's my own sort of, I'll have a great day one day doing a mix, and then I'll come home, and then I'll come back in the next day, and I'll absolutely hate it. And it's a frame of mind thing.
Yeah.
So, and that all just comes from probably being too hard on myself because of maybe a lack of confidence, maybe in some respects, but in other ways, it's just, it's not actually quite right sometimes. Most of the time, that's it really. But you're always listening for faults all the time, and it's not pleasant when you sort of doing music like that, but you can get perfection paralysis, which means you'll never do anything. Just going round and round in circles, just fiddling all the time, and it just doesn't get you anywhere. You've got to draw a line at some point. And I'm really pleased with this album. Yeah. I'm loving how it sounds. It sounds how I wanted it to sound. But then with Dave adding the magic to it, you know, it sounds even better than I imagined. So. I never thought I'd ever say that about anything. So, he's done a cracking job.
Just you know, hanging around the new album for a little bit. Just the intro to it has got so much going on in so many different styles. I got like a retro noir kind of vibe from the first song, the introduction to the album. And then, you know, obviously your amazing voice kicks in, there's guitar riffs, there's an orchestra kicking off in there, that kind of stuff. And you know, there's country vibes in the album as well. There's loads of different
styles. I like
styles
a load of different
it.
Music. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's taken a long time to get this finished
for
one reason or another, and a lot of it was just me not, it's just me being me, putting the brakes on things. But throughout that period, there's, you know, my taste in music changed. So I think at the very beginning, I was listening to things like Calexico or, you know, the Sadies and bands like that, which, you know, they play a lot of that kind of Ennio Morricone-inspired sort of Tex-Mex stuff. So that song, first single, was called, it's called Too Bad, but that was called Babbage Beatles Burrito.
Okay, fair enough.
I still can't even remember why. I think it was just as a reference point to kind of make me think where I kind of got the idea from. But yeah, so I mean, it started off like that, but you know, you've got all these other things. I was learning different sort of guitar picking styles and things like that. And I was listening to Phil Everly's first solo album. There's stuff off that. There's it's just all sorts of different things, and all I like so much, so many kinds of music. I think the thing about being in the Seahorses was that, you know, you're in an indie band and, you know, you see all these, we used to call them Liam Browns. They're these lads who just look like a cross between Liam Gallagher and Ian Brown. And, you know, and they all dress like they dress and everything. And it's, you know, and I get it. It's a thing. It's like being a mod. But you're kind of limiting yourself to other experiences and other music. It's just like, you're not allowed to do this. You're not allowed to do that. You can't wear this. You can't wear that. So many rules. It's kind of fascist in a way. But then the whole mod movement did come from Italy, so what can I say? But it's, I think that I'm a little bit more free than that.
Yeah.
I like bands like Blur, for instance, because that and Pulp and Supergrass, because they're not confined to any specific sort of genre. I know people will say that the word Britpop or the word this, that, and the other, but they've gone far beyond that. They haven't had, you know, they're not frightened to experiment. And David Bowie as well, you know, the same. He's like, I think he was quite famous for saying, don't ever play to the gallery. And if I think if you want to enjoy yourself as a creative person, then he's damn right, you know. I think I can get away with it. I don't have any management or, you know, a record company breathing down my neck telling me that I should be writing more songs that sounded like me 20 years ago, you know, and it's like, fuck that.
Yeah.
I'm not doing that. So, I mean, some people will probably be challenged, you know, they'll be like, oh, but it doesn't sound like the Seahorses. But then I was in, I was in a band called The Yards after the Seahorses split up. And then we were together for 7 years and we released 3 albums. And again, we were all into different stuff. And it's so liberating to do that. And you can release your own music now anyway and, you know, make enough of a living to continue to be as free-spirited as you want, really. I mean, at the end of the day, people have got to kind of like it enough to buy it. But but I think, I think I'm very happy where I am, actually. It's a good place to be.
Yeah, do you prefer it than having that machine around you?
I hated the machine with a passion.
Yeah.
And when it ever approaches, I get very anxious about it, and it's almost defensive, and I just don't want it anywhere near me. There's a lot of people to employ in within that kind of industry, you know, that don't necessarily for me don't need to be there. So to me, it's kind of like I end up working like 10 times as hard for the same amount of money. It just seems daft.
I mean, like, what specific parts of the machine really put you off that?
People.
Just dicks.
I tell you, I'm trying to be diplomatic here. It's exhausting. It's exhausting trying to be diplomatic. No, it's just all sorts. The thing is that the whole business model's changed now.
Right.
So back in the day, you'd sell loads of records, which would, you know, basically they'd invest a load of money in you. They would put a load of money into PR and all of that, and then send you around the world, and you'd do loads of interviews. It was pre-internet, pretty much, really, when I was doing the Seahorses stuff. So you're doing a lot of traveling around. When you're not gigging and you're not rehearsing, you're doing press. And it all made sense because that would all end up creating money, which would then, you know, you'd spend a lot of money and then you'd sell a lot of records and get the money back. That was the idea. With it now, it's like, the whole thing's completely changed. It's more about streaming now than anything. The physical products that you'll sell will be at gigs, you know, so it's kind of like there's only me to feed, really, at the end, you know, so it's kind of, I don't have a crew or anything like that. I'm very much completely independent. And it's not like by design. I've just seem to have arrived at this point. You know, a lot of bands out there, they're touring all the time because, you know, there's no money in Spotify. So this is what we have to do. And I hope you don't get to a point where the only people who can afford to get, you know, make music in the first place are these kind of trust fund kids that, you know, are straight out of Eton or whatever, you know, and they haven't really got any proper life experience.
Well, it ruined politics, didn't it? Those type of people making.
Oh, it ruins everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, shit people, that's it. So, yeah, quick answer to your question. What didn't I like about the industry is people.
Yeah.
Shit people.
Well, just rewinding a little bit and zooming out a little bit. What was the process like for you before Sea Horses and that kind of stuff? How did you physically like get into music yourself and realize you've got this fucking voice, this amazing voice and a talent for music?
I didn't even know. I thought everyone could sing. So it was I used to sing in the bath.
Yeah.
And, you know, I remember when my sister was at uni, she was a big Prince fan. And she'd left all her records at her house. So I remember getting Around the World in a Day, which is this gatefold like album. And I remember all the lyrics were on the inside. So I'd kind of put it as close to my head as possible and sing loud and think that no one could hear me.
Okay.
And I was there reading all the lyrics and stuff. And I realized that I could probably sing quite a lot. I mean, you know, Prince isn't very easy to sing. I won't be able to do it now. It's not too many fags, but, it kind of just thought that's what you did. You know, I wasn't really, didn't think anyone else could. I just thought people just couldn't be asked to do it.
Yeah.
And then there's one time I was singing in a bath somewhere. It's in a shared house when I was probably about 19, 20 maybe. And this lad, Andy Parrish, he could hear me. And he was staying in the house and he asked me to join a band with him. So I did. We wrote for our first song because I couldn't really remember the words for anyone else's. So we had to go up just doing something off our own back.
And what was the band name?
We started off with Genuine Moon Material, which was dreadful.
Nice.
Then it became Daisy Space, which is even more dreadful.
Yeah.
And then it was Chutzpah, or Chutzpah, if you want to phonetically pronounce it, which means shameless audacity, apparently, in Hebrew, I think. you know, and nobody was Jewish or anything in our band. It was, we ended up just having this wonderful experience traveling around France. And, you know, we didn't really know what we were doing, but we had a great, I can remember more about that one summer going around France than I can about pretty much any other stage of my life, really.
So you got out on the road and you went international with...
We went all over France and slept on beaches and just slept in graveyards and, you know, churchyards and stuff. And it was awesome. But you could do that back then. If you imagine, there was a lot of free festivals around as well. There was a lot of, you know, the police were a little bit frisky in France, but not as bad as they are now. You'll be able to do it now. You get arrested for some, I don't know, terrorism or something. But we used to just go and play the bars, just move around from one bar to the next and annoy all the punters in the bars until they gave us enough money for us to go away.
Nice.
But yeah, it was a good experience. And then I was busking for a bit. After France, moved back to York to continue doing some busking.
Mm.
And I just realized that it was so much nicer in France than it was in York anyway. So I moved down to Brighton and the band that was in Chutzpah, we split up. And then I moved to Brighton with my girlfriend and I tried to do a bit of busking down there, but the kind of music scene had changed. It was more I think the level is we're from Brighton. So if you'd given it like maybe 2 years earlier, you would have been able to make quite a decent living busking. But it was more DJs and kind of, you know, smackheads basically on the streets of Brighton. So it wasn't really quite what I expected. So I threw my time into writing songs, which I'd kind of been doing anyway, but not on my own. I was always writing them for the band I was in. So started writing pretty much about my experiences in France and people, and, you know, and that's where Blinded by the Sun came out. Plus Moving On came out then as well.
Is that when Seahorses were created then, around that time?
I was there in Brighton for about 6 months.
Right.
I went there in probably September and came back in January, I think. And then I kind of got a few, I think I had about 3 jobs and I was busking as well.
I was going to ask, have you ever had a real job or have you just been creative all your life?
Oh, I've had real jobs. I went to art college straight after school. So I moved to Scarborough when I was 16. Mm. And then after I finished that, I did graphic design. Mm. And then I worked in a pottery doing all sorts of bits and bobs there. I didn't really know what I was doing. I was really young. I moved to Whitby and then I was there for probably about 9 months, I think, and then moved back to York, worked at Apprentice, was a designer there, work maker back in the day. But music was always there. It was always playing in the background. Yeah. You know, I've worked in bars, I've had lots of jobs, but, I mean, character building stuff, I guess.
Yeah, well, you sound like you've lived all over the place. Did that help you? I don't know, come up with ideas or just?
It does a bit, you know. I mean, you get to know certain types of people and stuff. Yeah. I know it's not a dumb thing to sort of pigeonhole people into certain categories, but you know, I've always written about how I feel about things. I never really thought about it now until you ask. I mean, I've written hundreds of songs and they're probably all about the inner workings of my mind and how I feel about things. I ended up coming back to York and then was busking one day. A guy called Dennis walked past me. He was a mate of Martin Herbert, who's John Squire's guitar tech.
Right.
And he saw me busking and he said initially that I had the right haircut.
Right, okay,
and,
fair enough.
And then he was like, and I really like your songs, and so get me a tape and I'll put a photo in it and I'll send it to this guy. He's just left this really big band. And I was like, is it John Squire? And he was like, how the fuck did you know that? And I was like, well, I know he's been in York and I know he's asked Stuart Fletcher to play in a band with him, so it kind of makes sense. He's the only person that I know that's left a big band. Yeah. I didn't know John. Yeah. And then I gave him the tape in the end, and then he sent it to John. And he got to the top of the queue because it was handed straight to him. I think John had put an advert out in like the NME and other magazines advertising for band members, and I wasn't aware of that. So I suppose if I'd not gone out that day busking and that guy didn't walk past me, then you wouldn't be talking to me now.
Yeah, wow.
I'd probably be doing graphic design or working in a bar or something. Or who knows what I'd be doing.
So were you literally just plucked from your little busking world into the machine?
The record company wanted to make a bit of a deal of it. They wanted to kind of say that it was John that walked past and stuff like that, which I had a massive problem with. And I told them, don't say that because it's bullshit.
Yeah.
Everyone knows it's bullshit because all the people in York know what the story is. And,
yeah.
But they went and said it anyway. Right. Well, that's an example of shit people.
Another one. There we go. Yeah.
But I'm always at the mercy of that with, you know, basically you're a number on a spreadsheet at the end of the day. And I think John did some artwork recently, during COVID, where there was the, what do you call those little QR codes? And he'd done this, his own QR code, and he'd written into it kind of little sentence. And it took you quite a while to figure out what it said, but it says, "You are the commodity." And I thought that was genius. It's a very clever take on, I don't know what he meant personally for him, but I totally understood it for what it feels like to me. And, you know, it's basically, it doesn't matter how big or successful you are, you've always kind of got to answer to someone, I suppose. There's always someone who's trying to make money out of you. But that's maybe the tight Yorkshireman in me that I'm thinking that.
Well, I'm a Yorkshireman myself. I agree with all of that, you know. We are where we are with that, aren't we? But so, like, you know, I guess when you met up with the lads for the first time and John was there and you started creating music, you built this relationship to start this new band thing. John Squire as a character stands out to be, like, it feels like from the outside that he doesn't like the machine, he doesn't like the bullshit around him, and particularly when he were on Jonathan Ross overnight, when he just weren't playing the game, he was just giving him quick answer, just, you know, just being himself, he wasn't giving out too much.
I mean, you'd have to speak to him about it, yeah. But it does appear that way. I mean, I think he, with John, there's a huge level of expectation, you know, he'd done one of the best albums in existence, you know, with the Stone Roses first, and then he did the Second Coming. And, you know, there was kind of, he'd been built up into this thing that his guitar had got. And I'm not sure if it sat well with him, really. I don't really know. Yeah. He never really spoke about it. But that's a lot of pressure to put on someone. Mm. And you've got to maintain that kind of idea, which can be very limiting, I think. I don't know. I mean, I feel uncomfortable speaking about it because it's him.
Yeah.
And he'd answer it better.
Yeah.
I've got my feelings about it, and, you know, I don't think he probably wasn't really happy with the amount of the lack of control that he had over, you know, people loving it as much as they do. So, you know, it's crap when you can't go for a pint, you know, buy a pint of milk and, you know, people are trying to ask you for your autograph all the time. It doesn't happen to me anymore, thank God, but I'm sure it happens to him quite a lot.
Yeah.
That in itself can be quite draining. But I remember we supported the Rolling Stones a couple of times, about four times, I think it was now. And I met Charlie Watts in the toilet. I bumped into him in a box and he wasn't expecting to see anyone. So I nearly gave him a heart attack. And he went there with his security detail. And I was like, "How are you doing, Charlie? All right?" And he's going, "Who the fuck are you?" And I was like, "Oh, Chris, I'm in the support band." "We've got a support band." I was like, "Yeah, all right, never mind." Anyway, shook his hand and that was that. Yeah. But it made me think, you know, these guys have not had any, I've said this in other interviews as well, so forgive me if I'm repeating myself, but it's like they've not had a normal life since they were 19.
Yeah.
You know, and I love music and I love playing, but I'm not sure I could sacrifice my entire life for it, you know, for fame and fortune. Yeah. It just, then that whole thing becomes a big responsibility. You have to employ so many people and it's like, you know, you become this corporation that's employing hundreds, if not over 1,000 people. And that's all because someone's played three chords and sang a few notes over it. So it's resonated with people. It's insane. I don't know. I'm waffling on a bit here, but
okay. Did you realise that Do It Yourself, the Seahorses album, that for me personally was a sound check of my adolescent life, growing up and going out to pubs and starting to go and watch bands and that kind of stuff. How do you look back on that part of your life now and that album, that iconic album? How do you reflect on that now, looking back on it?
Well, back at the time, I knew there was going to be a level of expectation with it because of John's past. And because of that, I was catapulted a lot higher and further than I was comfortable with very quickly.
Yeah.
And I wasn't kind of educated in how to deal with that at any point.
Yeah.
So I had to basically put the blinkers on and then just put one foot in front of the other and just try not to be shit, I suppose, and just crack on with it. But then there's so many distractions. So really, I can't really say what it was like. Really, my memories of it are probably the reason why I can remember more of my experiences in chutzpah when we were in France, is because my eyes were wide open and I was kind of there just enjoying everything and it was all easy. Whereas in the Seahorses, I was like, almost like that, the shutters down, and I was just like, keep going and keep going and keep going. You know, it was very stressful. Mm. There was I enjoyed it, but it was a lot different to what people actually thought. But I think a lot of people probably thought I was really loving it all the time, I'd have to, if I'm honest, I'd say I wasn't really. I was just trying to join the dots. And then before you know it, the band splits up, and then you kind of left there going, right, thank God for that.
Mm.
But at the same time, you're thinking, what the fuck have I been doing for the last, two and a half years, 3 years, whatever, however long it was.
Well, that was back in the late 90s. So, you know, when did the Seahorses break up? Was it about 2000, 1999-ish?
1999, yeah.
Yeah.
By that point, I bought a house. Me and my wife back then, we had our son, Marley. Mm. So that's all I was kind of interested in, really. But, you know, I was very lucky, really, because, I could, I was in a position to buy a house and everything. So it was, I'm very grateful for the opportunity to have been in that band. It was definitely a life-changing moment. And I do look on some of it, fondly and stuff, but a lot of it was just a slog and just having to get through and trying to please everybody and failing miserably, it was one of them things, really. But
yeah. Does it still irk you a little bit to have to mention John Squire in every fucking interview?
Not at all, no. Yeah. I'm really pleased he's doing stuff with Liam. I can't get that Mars to Liverpool out of my head at all. It's just been going round and round and round. That chorus is mental. I mean, it's interesting. Obviously, they're literally everywhere you look at the moment, and it's great. Mm. And I'm really pleased for him. I mean, there's sometimes when I was in the studio and John had asked me to sing a bit more like Liam, and I'm always thought, but if you want Liam, if you want me to sound like Liam, just get Liam, to come in and do it. You are mates. because they were Love Me and Leave Me, I remember, together. And then I had the pleasure of singing that. So that was quite kind of cool.
Yeah, I can remember seeing you live at Party in the Pews last year in a church. I saw you live there. Yeah, Miles Hunt was on, and just a great, just hearing your voice in that magical church, that gig, that was a magical place. And you told a story about that. It's Liam and John's story, didn't you? I believe before.
Yeah,
you
I'm not sure if Liam can remember.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah,
It was strange, just coming into that world, and it's very hard not to be a fanboy about it all, and I actually just basically just put my poker face on and pretend that I wasn't overwhelmed by it all. I was quite lucky that I worked in a venue before I joined the Seahorses, so we had a lot of bands going through the venue, and you learned not to be kind of a bit gushy or giddy about things. But if you're meeting famous people all the time, it was just sort of didn't really know what to do or say. So they probably thought that was just really either quiet or aloof or probably drunk, actually, to be honest.
Well, it happens with me as an interview. I'm a massive fan of your work, so I'm holding it in a little bit. I'm trying to keep it, a little bit, I know you can pull the face and shit.
Soft.
I know, but you kind of,
gush like, away, gush
away. You're amazing, mate. You're absolutely fantastic. You've got an amazing body of work behind you. Do you look back at anything in the past around any changes you would have made, or that's it?
No, there's no point.
Yeah.
My friend I was talking to yesterday is another musician, and I've known him a long time.
Yeah.
He was a big inspiration. This guy called Dave Keegan. Mm. And he was talking about regrets and stuff, and he's a great songwriter, and he was talking about his regrets, and then he said, what are yours? And I was like, I don't have any. He's like, you must have some. And I'm like, no, I don't. Mm. It's pointless. I probably balls things up, but then as long as you say sorry to the right people and stuff, and know not to do it again. I think it's that's how you get through life, and you know, you learn, don't you?
Yeah.
But I don't have any regrets about anything.
Yeah, good, good. So the Seahorses broke up about 1999. I was just looking on your recording history. Ashes came out in 2008, so that's a bit of a gap. Was that like just family time, that kind of time? You said you bought your house and had a kid and that.
Yeah, it was kind of... I think I'd sort of started out with doing a lot of solo projects and things with different musicians, and it just got expensive, I think. And then it was like, well, you know, I need to kind of figure out, you know, the family balance with fulfilling my musical dream.
Yeah.
And obviously family comes first. So that would have been probably when I, you know, I ended up starting, I was working again.
Yeah.
I mean, I was always doing bits and bobs and writing and stuff. And then the Yards kind of formed. So Ashes came out after the Yards.
Right.
So
okay. I missed that bit.
There's, I think 2000, it might be two, I can't remember when the first Yards album was out. You'll have to look it up. But, yeah. So we had the Yards, and then there was Imperial Measures by the Yards, and then we did a live album. And then we split up, and then there was Ashes, which was a solo thing, because I was doing a lot of solo gigs at that point. I'd never really gone out and done solo stuff. And busking. And that was mine, so... I guess that's when I started to become my own, for lack of a better word, record company, I suppose.
What was there any themes behind all these breakups you've had? You seem to have had a lot of breakup in bands. Was there a particular theme that spreads through that?
A reason why. I think it's just that thing of you get older, you know, as time goes on, you've got more responsibilities, families and things like that. So, you know, people grow up, they have kids. And if it's not working out, like, you know, for whatever reason, whether it be financial or whatever, and or personal reasons, relationships, whatever, then, you know, it's not working, so you split up. I'm really, you know, still really good friends with everybody that was in the Yards. I did realise as time went on, though, that I kind of do enjoy being on my own. It's just less to worry about, you know. And if it's wrong, it's my fault. And if I'm not on time, it's my fault, you know. It's, you're not having to wait around for the people.
Yeah.
You can travel on, that sounds like a great misery, don't I? But I'm just like, you travel around on trains and watch a film and stuff like that, you know, and not feel guilty because you're not chatting about stuff. It's just like, I'm dreadful to be around when I'm touring. I do love my own space.
Well, you're on tour now, you're on this big acoustic. Is it all acoustic, the tour? I've seen all the dates and things, and I know you've got a gig tonight.
Yeah. So it's weird because I've got obviously quite a big sort of song, a lot of songs I can pull from at the moment. So my set list, I'll write one out, but very rarely stick to it. Yeah. You know, people are shouting out, you know, for songs that I haven't played for years. And sometimes I'll just throw them in. If I can kind of confidently think I can remember how they go, I'll do it. It's quite a nice loose way of doing things, and I do talk a lot in between the songs as well because I get quite nervous, so I do pretend that I'm actually playing in my living room and everyone in the building is my guest, and that makes me sort of feel like I'm kind of in control of things a bit better. I'm really enjoying what I'm doing, and the audiences seem pretty happy with it as well, so I don't think I'm going to be changing that set up anytime soon.
So did it take long to come up with the album name, World of Your Own? You kind of explained that you like being on your own and that kind of stuff, and you are
you
in
not really
own
wired. No, there's more to do with I got quite ill during COVID, and I'd already written a song called World of My Own anyway, but I was very poorly. I was in a lot of pain. I couldn't move. I was literally bedridden for 2 months, and they thought I had osteoarthritis, but they couldn't check because of it was lockdown. So, but I got better, thank God. But I was on a lot of painkillers at the time, and you know, if anyone's ever experienced that, you do feel like you're just in this lovely little warm bubble. And you know, it can be quite a creative experience as well. And you know, doing a lot of thinking, writing a lot of stuff. So I ended up changing quite a few of the lyrics for the song World of My Own. And then it was going to be called Honeycomb. There's a song on the album called Honeycomb, but I think World of My Own seemed to probably make a lot more sense, really. And then the whole sci-fi sort of theme that it's got.
Yeah.
There's an artist called Seasick Sailor, and he's done a lot of stuff for a lot of bands, and he's a great artist, and he's really, really good to work with. And we decided we should maybe go down this kind of a sci-fi sort of route, this kind of 1950s, 60s sort of sci-fi route.
Yeah.
And that's because of the title World of My Own. And then inadvertently, it reminded me that the Blinded by the Sun video is set in space as well, because I don't watch that sort of stuff for fun. But it was like, oh, yeah, so it's kind of doing this whole full circle thing. And I was going to totally scrap the idea, but then I thought, no, it doesn't matter. We'll just do it differently. But there seems to be these sort of happy coincidences. And then when I put I had the body of work, the 11 songs, I said to John Hargreaves, who basically wrote all the string arrangements and played keyboards and all the other bits and bobs on that kind of thing on the album. I asked him if he could do the segues in between each song, so the whole thing was continuous.
Yeah.
And he was like, well, what kind of vibe do you want? And I showed him the artwork, and he was like, oh, this is an absolute gift. And I was like, what do you mean? And he said, I've always wanted to sort of write in this sort of style of like 50s kind of sci-fi stuff. Mm. So this is a perfect opportunity to really do that. And then he said, what order do you want the songs in? And I was like, I'll leave that up to you, because you're the one who has to kind of figure it out. Mm. And he said, well, do you want to do it in an emotional context, or do you want me to just sort of do it depending on how easy it is from one key to the next? And I was like, well, what do you mean emotionally? And he goes, well, I've listened to the songs, and you are aware that this is quite an honest album. It's kind of exposes what's been going on in your life for the last 10 years. And I wasn't aware of that, but I left him to it. And he's done that thing. He's just done an amazing thing. So it's definitely bigger than the sum of its parts, really, because of what John's done and what he's added to it.
Mm.
And you can listen to the segues with the segues on, and you can listen to it without. But there's also, you can listen to the segues on their own as well, because in their own kind of, you know, even though they're only about maybe at the longest, about 30 seconds long, they're beautiful pieces of music, you know, in themselves, in their own right. But I guess it's hard to explain it. Best people better have to listen to it, I suppose.
Yeah, well, I encourage anybody.
It's going to be out on the 29th of March, but you can pre-order it on my website now.
Yeah, just so everybody, you know, anybody watching or listening to this, there's a link in the description of this interview where you can just click straight to it. You don't have to mess about, guys. And I'd encourage anybody to do it. I did want to ask you about the space thing, though. As I've got a bit older, I've started, like, watching more stuff on space. And just yesterday, a big rocket lifted off, which could potentially take civilization to Mars. Are you interested in that kind of stuff? Space interesting to you, like that kind of rocket?
I don't think
stuff?
I could afford it. I think you'd have to be one of these horrific.
I just mean the idea.
Hedge funds kind of right, 1%ers to go and do that.
Okay.
I'm interested that, you know, it's possible and everything. And sci-fi has got a lot to answer for. It's given a lot of people some really good ideas and some absolutely horrendous ones.
Yeah.
Look at Black Mirror, for instance. Yeah. You know, we seem to be living that right now. Yeah. But I think it's great, you know. The world is too small for a horrific species like us, so we need to go over to another one and fuck that planet up as well.
That's funny.
Oh, I am in a sour mood today.
I enjoy that kind of stuff. I enjoy that. So you're off out tonight. You know, the tour continues. There's a link in the description to this amazing album that's out on Friday. The first kind of song, it reminded me a little bit of Kill Bill. The beginning of the album, that's the vibe I were getting from it anyway. A little bit noir, a little bit vintage, Kill Billy kind of. I've just made some general notes when I was listening to it in gym this week. That's the kind of vibe.
Yeah, well,
I got
that's
from the beginning
kind
of it.
From the spaghetti western sort of stuff, right. Innit? So it's like, you know, hence the Calexico kind of influence. But yeah, this, I don't know if it actually does that at any other point in the album.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's, well, it is what it is. I guess people are just going to have to.
It's massive. It's massive. It really, like, do you know when you do, when you listen to a new piece of music and you think, and I'm not just blowing smoke up your ass, when you listen to a new piece of music and you're like, oh, nice, I found another thing I can fucking get right involved with, you know what I mean? It doesn't happen.
Oh,
that
good. Well, that's
I listen to a lot of music and it doesn't happen very often, that, and that happened with me when the album come on. I'm like, fuck yes, I've got another favorite thing that I can just hammer and listen to and just enjoy. I love
it. Oh, that's really kind. When we were recording it and writing it and stuff, you know, we don't really think about those sort of things.
Yeah.
We just want to get it done and finished and not be crap.
Yeah.
So it's really lovely. I was naively, and I should know better, but really stupidly surprised and shocked, really, that once people had heard it and it was released, the single was released, and the really lovely comments about it, and, you know, and I forgot that that's what happened.
Yeah.
I was expecting this terrific wave of kind of criticism, but that's not come yet. So I'm probably tempting fate there, but, you know, can't please everyone. But at the same time, I'm really pleased that it's gone down well and, you know, you like it because, you know, you obviously know what you're
about. I love
it.
And I've just ordered the vinyl as well, so you can – I've just ordered my version of the vinyl as well, because I was listening to it just on a Google link, so I got like a secret listen before today, but – I want it on vinyl. I just think I'm just going to sit down and enjoy it even more on vinyl, I think.
Well, the vinyl's a whole different experience because, like, it's just one continuous thing.
Mm.
Goes right through, you know, it's all... in the today's kind of playlisty Spotify world, you know, people don't really listen to albums from what start to finish.
Mm.
So there's just one song on a playlist, I guess, and where this is kind of old school, you know, it's more of a, it's not like a prog record or anything like that, you know, it's not like a concept album. If there is a concept, the concept is there wasn't a concept.
Yeah.
But it kind of comes across as that inadvertently. So yeah, it's quite a journey. I think that's what a lot of people have said when they've heard it. And it's, that's kind of what I think I wanted to do, really.
You seem quite relaxed coming up to the week of a new album coming out, mate. Are you looking forward to it?
Relaxed or knackered?
Okay, fair enough.
Maybe this is me putting the shutters back on again.
Right. Okay.
You know, it's like hide.
Right.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. I mean, I'm just glad that it's all coming out. You know, and it's.
Yeah.
I've got my mate Brad Blackwell, who's been helping me release it, you know, and without him, it wouldn't have happened.
Nice.
I'm dreadfully disorganized. I'm a massive procrastinator.
Yeah.
He's kind of like just cleared the path for it all to happen. So I can't thank him enough. Been working with Press on Vinyl as well, who have been fantastic. They're the pressing plant.
Oh yeah, I saw you on Twitter earlier this week, all smiley with your vinyl in your hand.
They're a relatively new kind of thing. They've been going for a couple of years now, but they're brilliant people. The enthusiasm is just off the scale, and I think everyone who works there love what they do, and they do it with a real passion, and it's great to see. So I'm glad that we decided to go with them. Yeah, I mean, it's nice. I've just met so many nice people over this whole process and stuff. And, you know, it's like yourself as well. So thanks again. Thanks for your kind words, Mr.
Well, you're very welcome. You're very welcome. Well, I know you've got to rush off. You're getting a train to your gig tonight. Chris Hell, really appreciate your time, mate. And if anybody's not pressed the link on the pre-link for the album yet, just press it. Stop over and over it. Treat yourself. You won't be disappointed. And enjoy the gig tonight, mate, and the rest of the tour. And keep doing Chris Allen stuff. It's great. Nice one.
I'll try. I don't think anyone else could do it. Thanks again, mate. Cheers,
pal. Thanks again. Oh, thanks, Chris. Nice one. You enjoy that? A little trip down memory lane into the history of the musical archives. What a great journey he's been on, and I can't. Basically, I can't get you enough to press the album. stream it on Friday. Just buy the album. I bought the vinyl version. That's on its way. Just treat yourself to the album. I promise you, you will not be let down. It's an absolute joy. I'm not blowing smoke up any fucker's arse. I don't do that. It's an absolute belter, honestly. That's my sales pitch. Well, it's not a sales pitch. It's what I believe. So I'm not apologising for anything. As always, ladies and gentlemen, if you're listening to this audio version of the podcast, you can watch our little interviews and our faces on the YouTube, which is over there. So you can see me and Chris have a little chat and a natter and that. And as always, thanks for joining us for another week here at the RGMA Experience Podcast, ladies and gentlemen. Tell your friends about it. Leave us a review. There's a link to click through Amazon and whatever you buy. We get a little kickback, so you can show your support by just buying stuff on Amazon through the link in the description. It just takes you straight to Amazon. Whatever you buy, we get a little kickback. Don't cost you out extra. Just helps us out, you know, keep it going. We're nearly 150 weeks in. Oh. But anyway, I'm going to let you get off to get on with your own business, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for listening right up to the end of this podcast. It means a lot. Thank you. And as always, hope you have a great week of music ahead of you. I've been Carl Maloney. I'm going to get off. Toodaloo. Welcome to RGM. Are you in a band? Come and join us. Simply click on the RGM submission page, submit your music, and we'll sort the rest.
Hello. Did you know that you can support our podcast in many ways? Within the description of this podcast, you will see a list of all the equipment that we use. These are Amazon affiliate links. Clicking on these links take you to Amazon. If you buy whatever you're planning that week, we get a small kickback and you get a parcel at no extra cost. We would really appreciate your support. Or you can just go old school and donate a pound or whatever you feel is appropriate in there. Please subscribe, tell a friend about our show. And thank you for your support, and we will see you next week.
Come on,